Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is being held in association with the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley. I'm Fred Martin, a visiting scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at the University of California at Berkeley, and past president of the Abraham Lincoln Institute of Washington, D.C., and your chair for tonight's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, Michael Burlingame, historian and author of a new two-volume work, Abraham Lincoln, A Life. Michael Burlingame is best known as a scholar who for some 50 years has been a fixture in every nook and cranny of Lincoln repositories. Born in Washington, D.C., an ancestor, Anson Burlingame was a member of Congress and then Lincoln's minister to China. Burlingame, California is named for him. Michael came under the wing of the late famed David Herbert Donald at Princeton as a research assistant. This launched his Lincoln scholarship. Michael, like Donald, went from Princeton to Johns Hopkins University, where he earned his Ph.D. In 1968, he joined the History Department of Connecticut College in New London, retiring in 2001. Currently, he is the Distinguished Chair in Lincoln Studies at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Michael is the author and editor of many Lincoln books, including The Inner World of Abraham Lincoln. His newest two-volume, Abraham Lincoln, A Life, sets a high bar for Abraham Lincoln scholarship. Christopher Hitchens gave it a stunning review in the current Atlantic Monthly. Please welcome my friend and colleague, Professor Michael Burlingame.
Well, thank you for that very kind introduction, Fred. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm always glad to be in a state that has the good judgment to name a town Burlingame. Before I begin my formal remarks, I thought I might tell you a little bit about how I became a Lincoln scholar in the first place. As Fred mentioned, I was born and raised in Washington, D.C. This was just slightly after the unfortunate event at Ford's Theater. I don't mean to joke about my age. I'm 67, but I prefer to think of it as 19 Celsius. Feel free to use that. I got it from Tom Lehrer. Anyway, so growing up in Washington, D.C., Ford's Theater, the White House, the Lincoln Memorial, picnics at Manassas were all part of my childhood landscape, and I think that helped predispose me to be a Lincoln scholar. Another thing was having David Donald as my mentor. As a college freshman, I took a course with him in the Civil War Reconstruction. He took me under his wing, made me his research assistant, and I became a devoted student of his. When he left Princeton to go to Johns Hopkins after my sophomore year, I followed him down there and worked under his direction. And if he had been a medievalist, I would probably be writing about the Middle Ages today. Another reason why I think I became a Lincoln scholar is because, as Fred mentioned, I have an ancestor, Anson Burlingame, who was Lincoln's ambassador to China. But I think the most important reason why I became a Lincoln scholar was because of an episode that took place between my junior and senior years at college. And that summer, I had a job at the Library of Congress Manuscript Division, processing original documents. And it was quite exciting to hold letters that had been written, that had only been read by the recipient and had never been seen by scholars. And some of these letters talked about Lincoln. It was very exciting. And the man who had obtained the job for me at the Library of Congress was the chairman of the History Department at Princeton, and he spent his summers at the Library of Congress working on a magisterial history of European economic development. And at noontime, he would regularly come by the manuscript division and invite me to join him and his friends, who were very eminent historians of Europe and the United States, for lunch. And for a callow youth of 20, as I then was, to have lunch with these eminent scholars was quite exciting. And one day, a bunch of us were sitting around a table at the Library of Congress cafeteria, and one of the historians started to talk about Douglas Southall Freeman. As some of you may know, Freeman was an eminent historian who wrote a 4-volume biography of Robert E. Lee and a 3-volume study of Lee's lieutenants. And at the end of his life, he was writing a multi-volume biography of George Washington. And this fellow said, you know, there's a funny thing about Freeman. As each of the volumes of the Washington biography appeared, you could detect changes in the author. He began to adopt Washington's gestures, and he began to adopt Washington's mannerisms. And as time went by, he even began to speak in 18th century locutions and sort of sound like George Washington. And by the end of his life, he even began to look like George Washington. Well, I straightened up my bow tie. I remember this quite vividly. And said, well, when I graduate from college, I'm going on to a PhD program in the Civil War and Reconstruction. And people have told me that I look like Abraham Lincoln. At which point, my chairman banged his fist on the table, and all the knives and forks and spoons leapt up into the air, and they came clattering back down to the green formica-clad tabletop, causing a ruckus that impelled people all around us to turn their heads about to see what the noise was all about. And my chairman announced in a voice that could have been heard in Baltimore if the door had been open, he said, holy mackerel, Mike, you're ugly, but you're not that ugly. And ever since that day, I think I knew I was fated to be a Lincoln scholar. And one of the great joys about being a Lincoln scholar is that Lincoln had a great sense of humor. He loved to tell good jokes, and good stories were told about him. And when you do research on him, you're bound to run into these. And one day I was doing research in the New York Public Library in the main reading room, and it's always jammed. There were people all around me, before me, to my right, to my left, behind me. And I was going through a series of reminiscences written by people who had known Lincoln. And you can't do work in such sources without encountering funny stories. So I was going through these reminiscences, and about a half hour into my work, I encountered a good joke that Lincoln told. And without stopping to think where I was, I burst out laughing. And everybody around me went, shh, shh, shh. I said, oh, excuse me, forgive me. And I returned to my work, and another half hour passed, and another funny joke appeared. And once again, without stopping to think where I was, I burst out laughing. Well, everybody around me this time a little more emphatically went, shh, shh, shh. I said, oh, forgive me, excuse me, I'm sorry. Well, it happened a third time. At which point, the woman sitting across from me, who was taking notes from a thick sociology tome, and she was very earnest. It's a woman of about my vintage. And she leaned across the table, and she fixed me with her gaze, and she said, just what is your field anyhow? I think I'm going to switch to it. Calls to mind that scene in the movie when Harry met Sally. I'll have what she's having, right? Right. Okay. Okay, well, enough levity. Let's get down to business. A question that's doubtless on your mind is, what in the world new can be said about Abraham Lincoln? What justifies a new 2,000-page biography? That's the one that Fred alluded to. It's called Abraham Lincoln, A Life. Be sure to buy it. You don't have to read it, but be sure to buy it. And I must say that when I started work on Lincoln 25 years ago to write what became The Inner World of Abraham Lincoln, which was a series of psychological essays about his relations with his parents and his wife and his children and so on and so forth, a book that I wanted to call Shrinkin' Lincoln, but my publisher wouldn't let me. In any event, when I started working on that book, I assumed that everything important about Lincoln had already been unearthed and published. Everything he had said, everything that had been said about him, about his administration, and that was available either in published book form or article form, and I wouldn't therefore have to go and do the grubby work of schlepping around the country and going to archives and going through unpublished material. And so I drafted the book based on that assumption, using published material. But then I said, well, I should really do some original research in unpublished sources. And so I went to Brown University, which is about an hour away from New London, Connecticut, where I was then based. And in the first hour of the first day that I did original unpublished research and original unpublished documents, I discovered a tremendous new cache of information, brand new information about Lincoln. I went to the card catalog at the John Hay Library. Some of you, I think, are probably old enough to remember what a card catalog is. And I just went to L and started looking under Lincoln, and I discovered a series of interviews that had been conducted by Lincoln's personal secretary during the White House years with people who had known Lincoln. This was 10 years after the assassination. And in these interviews, there was all kinds of really startling and important new information. And I was astounded. And so I asked the librarians at Brown, I said, I can't believe this. You've been very conscientious about cataloging and describing and indexing and making available these materials. And I'm very familiar with the published work on Lincoln, but I've never seen any of this information alluded to or cited. And I can't understand it, not even by people at Brown. All they have to do is walk across the street to the John Hay Library. And I was told by the librarians, well, Abraham Lincoln is a dead white male. It's not very fashionable these days to write about dead white males. You're much more likely to get ahead in history departments if you write on topics like, well, homosexuality among 19th century Chinese pirates, cultural hegemony and the corset panic of 1921. You know, I'm not making these up. These are real topics. And I said, well, so be it, but these seem to me to be pretty important materials, and I published that as an oral history of Abraham Lincoln's, my second book. And then I said, well, this is interesting because these interviews that were conducted 10 years after the assassination were meant to be used by the interviewer, a guy named John Nicolay, as part of his 10-volume biography of Lincoln that he was writing with his assistant secretary, John Hay. But they decided not to use these interviews in their book because they had been granted exclusive access to the Lincoln papers that Robert Todd Lincoln, Lincoln's son, controlled. And so they decided, we won't use these reminiscences where people are talking about events that occurred 10 years, 15, 20 years earlier, because like most historians, you prefer to use documents that were contemporary with the material that you're writing about. And your reminiscences have to be used carefully because people's memories play tricks on them. As Mark Twain once said, the older I get, the more vividly I remember things that never happened. But if you use these carefully with contemporary documents, they can be extremely helpful. And so I said, I bet you that other early biographers of Lincoln went out and interviewed people who knew Lincoln, and some of the material that they gathered wound up in their books, but a lot of it probably got left on the cutting room floor. Because editors are always telling you, condense your book, trim it, cut it down. Now, my editor at the Johns Hopkins Press was very strict and limited me to 2,000 pages. And so I went to Allegheny College in Meadville, Pennsylvania, where the papers of Ida Tarbell are located. Now, Ida Tarbell is a name you might recognize as a muckraking journalist in the late 19th and early 20th century who exposed the peccadilloes of Standard Oil. But she also did a 2-volume biography of Lincoln. And so I went to her papers and discovered another tremendous cache of interviews, some of which showed up in her book, but a lot of which didn't. And I asked the librarians there, I said, I can't believe this material hasn't been more widely used. And I was told, well, you're the first person to spend more than a day here working with these in my 30 years at this library. And I spent a month in Meadville 1 week. It's a pretty dreary little town. And so then I looked at other manuscript collections and found equally valuable interview material. But then I said to myself, manuscript collections that contain reminiscences are fine, but let me take a look at contemporary manuscript collections, that is, collections of documents written at the time Lincoln was president and in his pre-presidential period. And I discovered lots of new good material there. And let me share with you one of the most dramatic finds I made. This was in the Frederick Douglass papers at the Library of Congress. Now, everybody who writes about Lincoln and race cites a speech that Frederick Douglass gave in 1876, 11 years after Lincoln's death. And in that speech, Frederick Douglass said famously, Abraham Lincoln was preeminently the white man's president. preeminently the white man's president, and we black people were only his stepchildren. Well, I discovered in the Frederick Douglass papers a speech that Douglass had given on June 1st, 1865, 6 weeks after Lincoln's death. And in this speech, written out in Frederick Douglass's handwriting, was the phrase, "Abraham Lincoln was emphatically the black man's president." I thought, whoa, this is astounding. And I said to myself, how could I have missed this? Because I had gone through the five-volume edition that the Yale University Press had recently published of all of Frederick Douglass, what they alleged was all of Frederick Douglass's speeches. And I said, how could I have missed this? So I went back to that five-volume edition, and lo and behold, that June 1st, 1865 speech is not there. And so I was startled by that omission, so I wrote to the people at Yale and asked, why did you leave that speech out? No response. So I called and left a message. No response. Well, those of us who went to Princeton aren't surprised Yale would conduct itself this way, but what can I tell you? And that speech is truly remarkable, not only for that very dramatic phrase, but Frederick Douglass goes on to say that Abraham Lincoln was the first American president to rise above the prejudice of his time and his country. By inviting me to the White House to consult on public affairs, Lincoln was saying to the country, I am the president of the black people as well as the white people, and I mean to honor their rights as men and citizens. And in order to emphasize the reason why he believed that Abraham Lincoln should be considered emphatically the black man's president, Frederick Douglass cited Lincoln's second inaugural address. Now, when we think of the second inaugural, we think of the last paragraph, with malice toward none, with charity for all, and so forth. But Frederick Douglass cited the previous paragraph to illustrate his point. And that paragraph is truly remarkable, because in it, Lincoln addresses a question that had been on his mind for some time. Namely, why is the Civil War so bloody? Why has it gone on so long? Why have so many men died? Why have so many widows and orphans been created? And Lincoln wrote himself a memo about this question, in which he tried to clarify his thinking. And in order to clarify his thinking, he used to sometimes just write out statements, not for public consumption. And in one of these statements, he deals with this question. Why is the war so long? Why is the war so bloody? And in fact, 620,000 men died in the Civil War. That's as many men as died in all the other wars in American history combined, from the Revolution through Korea. If you add up the total who died in the Revolution, the War of 1812, the Mexican War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, and Korea, you get the same number. So Lincoln says in this memo to himself, I don't understand why God allowed this war to begin in the first place. And having begun, I don't understand why God allows it to go on and on and on. He could stop it at any point, and yet it goes on. More widows are made, more men are killed. What is God's purpose? In his second inaugural address, Lincoln shares with his audience, with the country, his conclusion about that question. And here's what he said. The Almighty has his own purposes. And then Lincoln quoted from Jesus in the Gospel of St. Matthew. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come. But woe unto that man by whom the offense cometh. Lincoln then said, if we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which must needs come in the providence of God, but which he now wishes to remove, and he gives to both North and South this terrible war, as the woe due unto them by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from the attributes of that have always been ascribed to God by believers in the living God? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. But if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn by the lash shall be paid for by another drawn by the sword, all we can do is say, as was said 3,000 years ago, the ways of the Lord are righteous and just altogether. Well, this is a remarkable statement, that the Civil War is God's punishment on white people for having enslaved black people, North and South. And one of the most moving experiences I have when I visit Washington, which is often, is to go to the Lincoln Memorial and watch parents read to their children the second inaugural address. When you go to the Lincoln Memorial and you stand in front of that enthroned statue of Lincoln, if you look to the right, you'll see the complete text of the second inaugural, and to the left, the Gettysburg Address. And I always find it deeply moving to see parents with young children read to them the second inaugural with this remarkable statement about the meaning of the Civil War. And I think it's a remarkable tribute to Lincoln that he said it, and it's a remarkable commentary on the American people that we regard that as such an important document in our history. Well, I found in the Frederick Douglass papers another speech which was omitted from the Yale University edition. This was a speech that Lincoln gave in December of 1865, so we're several months after the assassination. And in this speech, Frederick Douglass deals with the question of black suffrage. And he says, "I and my fellow abolitionists, when we heard Abraham Lincoln on April 11th call for limited black suffrage, didn't fully appreciate how important that was. Because Lincoln, 2 days after Robert E. Lee surrendered, gave a speech, an important speech, in which he said, dealing with Reconstruction, that he believed that black people should be allowed to vote, at least those who had served in the Union Army and those who were very intelligent, by which we assume he meant literate. And Douglass said that he and his fellow abolitionists were disappointed by that call for limited black suffrage because it was too limited, just Army veterans and the very intelligent. But, Frederick Douglass says, we should have known that that was extremely significant, because Abraham Lincoln learned his statesmanship in the school of rail splitting. And to split a rail, you take a wedge, and you insert the thin edge of the wedge into the log. You then take a large hammer, a maul, and you drive home the thick edge of the wedge. And we should have known that once Abraham Lincoln inserted the thin edge of the wedge into the log, you could count on him to drive home the thick edge of the wedge. And therefore, we should have realized that the situation would be much different today with Lincoln as president rather than Andrew Johnson. And he went on to say that for all Americans, the death of Abraham Lincoln is a tragedy. But for black people, it is an unspeakable calamity. Now, there was one member of the audience on that April 11, 1865, who did fully appreciate the significance of Abraham Lincoln's call for limited black suffrage. And that was a charismatic young actor named John Wilkes Booth. And when he heard Lincoln call for limited black suffrage, he turned to his colleagues and said, "That means nigger citizenship. That's the last speech he's ever going to give. By God, I'm going to run him through." And 3 days later, he assassinated Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln should therefore be considered not just a victim of somebody who resented the Emancipation Proclamation, which, by the way, here's on my tie, along with a little lunch. Lincoln was not killed because he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, liberating slaves in the areas that were still in resistance to the Union. He was not killed because he supported the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery throughout the country. Abraham Lincoln was murdered because he called for limited black suffrage, for black citizenship rights. And therefore, I think it's appropriate for us to think of Abraham Lincoln as a martyr to black civil rights, as much a martyr as Martin Luther King, or Medgar Evers, or Viola Liuzzo, or James Reeb, or Mickey Schwerner, or Andrew Goodman, or any of those other people who were murdered in the 1960s as civil rights activists. So those are new insights I gathered about Lincoln's presidency. Now, what about his pre-presidential period? Well, I discovered in another source a striking new aspect of Lincoln, and that was Lincoln's journalism. Lincoln, we know from the memoirs of his law partner, wrote regularly for the Springfield Whig newspaper. But nobody had attempted, that I was aware of, to identify just what Lincoln had written. And so I went through, day by day, through the Springfield Illinois State Journal, looking for items that I was pretty sure were by Lincoln. And I discovered in that newspaper at least 200 pieces that I'm pretty sure are by Lincoln. And I'm sorry to report that you aren't going to find any second inaugurals or Gettysburg addresses in these items. These are low-road political attacks on Democrats. Lincoln was a Whig, and these articles tended to be sarcastic, ridiculing of Democrats. Lincoln was a specialist at that. In fact, Lincoln in his early political career, in his 20s and his 30s, was something of a political hack. You see very little of the statesmanship that Lincoln displayed in his 40s and 50s in the Lincoln of his 20s and his 30s. And this tended to reinforce a feeling that I had developed in my earlier work on Lincoln, that is to say that he went through tremendous growth, not during his presidency so much, but between the first and second portions of his political career. In his 20s and his 30s, he's a low-road politician. In his 40s and his 50s, he's a high-road politician, an eloquent, passionate, articulate spokesman for the anti-slavery cause. In between those two periods, you have a five-year hiatus in which Lincoln basically dropped out of politics. And in those 5 years, little seemed to be actually going on in Lincoln's life. He was practicing law, dabbling in politics a little bit, but doing very little. He wasn't running for office. He had run for office every opportunity he had in his 20s and his 30s, and then from 45 till his death at the age of 56, he also was running for office. But in those 5 years, he dropped out. Nothing seemed to be going on the surface, but beneath the surface, tremendous growth was taking place. And all the qualities that you find that make Lincoln a distinguished president, his eloquence, his ability to get a coalition of anti-slavery forces to work together, his preternatural sense of political timing, all those things you see in Lincoln in Illinois in the 7 years before his presidency. So the growth that took place was in this five-year period between the age of 40 and 45. And in that period, he does develop into this remarkably psychological, whole, and mature statesman. And I speculate that he went through what many men go through, that is, a profound midlife crisis. We know from modern psychological studies that a lot of men between the age of 40 and 45 engage in intense introspection. Have I made the right career choice? Have I made the right marital choice? What do I want to leave as a legacy? What's truly important? All these kinds of questions can lead to what we commonly call a midlife crisis. And out of that, we know from some psychological studies, can come tremendous growth. And it seems to me that Lincoln is one of the most dramatic examples of a successful midlife crisis in American public life. Now, what do I mean by tremendous psychological growth, psychological maturity, psychological wholeness? Well, one of the things that I find most striking about Lincoln was his ability to overcome the petty tyranny of the ego. Now, most people tend to have needy egos. That's particularly true for people in politics and show business. As you may know, some people define politics as show business for ugly people. In any event, Lincoln was able, as president, and indeed as organizer of the Republican Party in Illinois, to overcome the tyranny of the ego. He refused to take things personally. He refused to take criticism personally. He refused to take disagreement personally. And this was one of the secrets of his success as president. He was able to keep the North united, keep the Republican Party united, because he refused to engage in quarrels, he refused to take things personally. It's been argued by a very distinguished historian that if a man like Lincoln had been president of the South, and a man like Jefferson Davis had been president of the North, the South might well have won the Civil War. I think there's a lot of truth in that. Because Jefferson Davis was more like a typical politician. He was thin-skinned, he took criticism personally, he took disagreement personally, and as a result, he quarreled with his vice president, he quarreled with his cabinet, he quarreled with his generals, he quarreled with his Congress, he quarreled with his editors, he quarreled with almost everybody. Lincoln, on the other hand, refused to do that. And I'd like to close my formal remarks by sharing with you my favorite Lincoln quote. This is from a letter that he wrote to a young Union captain in the middle of the Civil War. And this young Union captain had been squabbling with his superior officers. And Lincoln took time out to give him some wise paternal advice. And in it, he quoted from Shakespeare, one of his favorite authors, quoted from Hamlet, from Polonius's speech to Laertes. You recall that one. That's the one that contains such chestnuts as, "To thine own self be true, and neither a borrower nor a lender be," so on. Well, Lincoln says to this young Union captain, "The advice of a father to a son," and then he quotes Polonius, "beware of entrance to a quarrel, but being in, bear it that the opposed may beware of thee." Lincoln said, that advice is good, and yet not the best. Quarrel not at all. No man resolved to make the most of himself can spare time for personal contention. Still less can he afford to take all the consequences, including the vitiating of his temper and the loss of self-control. Yield greater things to which you can show no more than an equal claim, and lesser things, though clearly your own. Better to give your path to a dog than be bitten by him in contesting for the right. Even killing the dog would not cure the bite. I thank you for your attention.
Our thanks to Michael Burlingame, historian and author of the new 2-volume work, Abraham Lincoln, A Life, for his comments this evening. I'm Robin Einhorn, professor of history at the University of California at Berkeley, and I will be moderating today's audience question period. Professor Burlingame, we have a number of questions, so let's begin. And why don't we just start right in with the psychological question? Someone asks, was Lincoln clinically depressed?
Was Lincoln clinically depressed? On two occasions, Lincoln did go through what would, in modern parlance, be referred to as bouts of clinical depression. That is, he was so seriously depressed, he was suicidal. The first occasion was in his mid-20s when his sweetheart, Ann Rutledge, died. His friends were so worried that he would kill himself that they removed sharp objects from his reach, lest he do so. He came out of that. Then, when he broke his engagement to Mary Todd in his early 30s, he also went into a deep depression. And once again, his friends worried that he might do himself in. And they guarded him for weeks, and eventually he snapped out of it. So those were the two episodes when he was really debilitated by depression. On other occasions, he was predisposed to be gloomy, to be depressed, but he was not debilitated by it. And I try in my book, or my books, to analyze the origins of that depression. And I speculate that they have to do with the death of Lincoln's mother when he was 9 years old, the death of his baby brother in infancy, the death of his older sister in childbirth when Lincoln was in his late teens, and that those deaths profoundly predisposed him toward depression. And modern clinical studies have shown that one of the origins of depression in some people is the early death of a parent. Now, the damage done by the early death of a parent can be mitigated if the surviving parent is emotionally nurturant and available and supportive. But Lincoln's father does not fit that description. Lincoln and his father were quite estranged and different folks. And so I think that that's the origin of Lincoln's depression. Now, a very fine book was recently published analyzing the effects of Lincoln's depression, arguing that his experience of depression helped predispose him to be more empathetic to people who were suffering, to have more of a humanitarian outlook in general. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. So the answer is he was clinically depressed on two occasions and predisposed to depression throughout his life, but was not debilitated by it.
And in this same kind of personal life vein, you write extensively about his marriage.
Yes.
And about Mary Todd Lincoln's various activities, particularly during his presidency. I was wondering if you wanted to say something about that.
Everything you've heard about Mary Todd Lincoln and how disagreeable and ornery and impossible she was is inaccurate. She was worse. And I should preface my remarks by saying that Mary Todd Lincoln, in my view, is much more to be pitied than censured. She suffered a great deal starting at the age of 6. Her mother dies when she's 6. Her father promptly remarries a much younger woman. The new wife says to the husband, "Don't pay attention to that first batch of 6 children you had by your now deceased first wife. Pay attention to the 9 children we're going to have." Well, Robert Todd Lincoln did sire 16 children. Well, every man should have an occupation. So this new stepmother then convinces the father to tune out Mary and her siblings and just pay attention to the second batch of children. This is a classic problem that we run into today. We call it blended families. And we tend to think of it as a problem that has really been created by the high incidence of divorce in modern times. But in fact, it's an ancient pattern that was created by the high incidence of death among women, particularly in childbirth. And then Mary Todd Lincoln suffers other major losses. 3 of her 4 children die before they reach adulthood. Now, even by 19th century standards, that's a very high percentage of your children to lose. And a terrible blow to have your husband murdered at your side at the peak of his fame and fortune. So the Almighty ladles out a fair amount of misery on all our plates, but it seems to me that her portion was particularly heaping. Having said that, it should be noted that she behaved very badly. She physically abused her husband. Now, this may seem a little startling that a man who was 6'4" tall should be abused by a woman who was 5'2". But we have testimony from neighbors, from servants in the house, from political associates, from law associates, to the effect that she would regularly strike him, that she would draw blood, that she would chase him out of the house with a knife, she would chase him out of the house throwing potatoes at him, and that this was a regular feature of her behavior. In addition, as First Lady, she engaged in all kinds of unethical activity. She padded payrolls. She padded expense accounts. She pinched the salaries of White House servants. She sold cotton trading permits. She sold pardons. And Lincoln tells one of his close friends, and this I discovered that first day I was at Brown doing original research, he tells one of his friends regularly in the White House that he was terrified that his wife would do something to humiliate him publicly. And she did. She became a major source of embarrassment for the Lincoln presidency. And in the 1864 election, the Democratic opposition made a big to-do of her misconduct in the White House. So it is one of the more sad episodes in Lincoln's life, the story of his marriage. And there's a tendency in modern historical scholarship to sweep these episodes under the rug. And if you do that, you fail to appreciate how deep Lincoln was in sorrow and why he has to be considered a man of sorrows. It wasn't just because of his own troubled childhood, but the marriage that he endured was extremely painful. Now, so what, you might say? What difference does this make? Isn't this just the People magazine approach to history? Isn't this just gossip? Well, no. I think that the story of the Lincoln marriage is important in a number of ways. One, Lincoln probably wouldn't have been president if it weren't for his wife. And that's what his friends said. Many of his friends testified that she made life so uncomfortable for him at home that that he spent a lot of time away from home doing what we would today call networking. Lawyers in Springfield couldn't make enough money by just staying in Springfield. So every spring and every fall, the lawyers went out on the circuit. They went from one county seat to the next, and the farmers would all sue each other, and the lawyers would facilitate this. And Lincoln was the only lawyer who went out on the first day of the circuit, who stayed out on the circuit till the end of the circuit each spring and each fall. And he was the only lawyer who didn't go home on weekends. And all the other lawyers said it's because he had just an unhappy home life. Well, out there on the circuit, he made lots of friends, socialized a lot. And then when he was back home, he would stay out at night and go to committee meetings and civic meetings and the like, and again, network. Now, George Bernard Shaw says in one of his plays, Heartbreak House, he has his mouthpiece, Captain Shotover, say, "Who are the men who achieve things in the world and accomplish things? The husband of the shrew and the drunkard, the men with the thorn in their flesh." Well, I don't necessarily vouch for that as the secret for all successful men, but it seems to me Lincoln is a case in point. Another way in which the marriage was important is that Lincoln was ambitious, but Mrs. Lincoln was even more ambitious. And if it hadn't been for her goading him, he may not have gone as far in politics as he did. And this, too, is something that his friends commented on. His ambition was like a rocket, but her ambition, supplementary ambition, was a kind of afterburner to that rocket. And Lincoln's favorite play was Macbeth. He said, there's nothing like Macbeth. Macbeth is wonderful. And I think the reason why Lincoln enjoyed Macbeth so much is that it resonated with him. It's a story of a loveless marriage between two ambitious people in which the wife is more ambitious than the husband. And finally, I think the story of the marriage is important because it helps explain one of the things that made Lincoln a successful president. And that was because of his remarkable ability to deal with difficult people. When you see how he dealt with George McClellan, with Charles Sumner, with these editors, Horace Greeley, members of Congress, members of the cabinet, Salmon Chase, William Henry Seward, truly remarkable that he could get along and deal with these difficult people. And one of the reasons he was able to do so is that he had a lot of practice at home. And I don't mean to be facetious about this, but I really believe this is the case. So the story of the marriage is of more than just antiquarian gossip interest, I think.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is historian Michael Burlingame, renowned expert on Abraham Lincoln. So I'd like to turn to the question of race. And you've told us about really quite incredible speech toward the end of his life where he looks forward to enfranchising African-American men. And, of course, we all know, or many of us know, about the way he talked about African-Americans in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Right. And so I'm wondering, are we talking about an actual change? Are we thinking that the early racism, white supremacist talk was pandering and he was a good guy all along? Or how do we deal with this?
Well, your allusion to the 1858 Lincoln-Douglas debates is an important one. In those debates, in that 1858 campaign in Illinois, when Stephen A. Douglas and Lincoln were competing for that Senate seat, Stephen A. Douglas engaged in the most outrageous race baiting. The story of Douglas's race baiting in the 1858 campaign has not been fully told, or at least I discovered when I was doing my research, because in order to find what Douglas said in that campaign, you must look beyond the seven debates that Douglas and Lincoln held. And tracking down Douglas's speeches is hard. You have to go to newspapers to get them. They're not easily available. And if you do that, you find that Douglas was not just demagogic in the debates. He was even more demagogic outside the debate context. And time and time again, he hammered Lincoln for being soft on race, soft on blacks, that he believed that black people, he argued, if Lincoln were elected, black people would soon be jurors and voters, and they would be holding office, and they would be intermarrying with whites, and the country would go to hell in a handbasket. And Douglas was shameless in this racial demagoguery. And Lincoln had been, at the beginning of the campaign, had made statements which Douglas hammered away at. One was, at the beginning of the campaign in Chicago, Lincoln says, let's stop this quibbling about which race is superior and which race is inferior, and all unite in affirming once again that glorious statement in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. Well, Douglas and the Democrats hammer and hammer and hammer away at this. And Lincoln finally feels compelled to respond to this. And at one of the debates, he starts off by saying, I do not believe black people should be allowed to be voters, jurors, allowed to intermarry with whites, or office holders. But, Lincoln went on to say, I do believe that black people have every right to earn in the sweat of their brows what they earn they should be allowed to keep. That it's monstrous that the slave owners have rewritten the word of God Almighty himself. When God expelled Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden, he put a curse on males. He said, in the sweat of thy brow shalt thou eat thy bread. And Lincoln said, it's a monstrous perversion of the word of God Almighty himself that the slaveholders have rewritten that to read, in the sweat of somebody else's brow shalt thou eat thy bread. And Lincoln said, informally, that when it came to interracial marriage, if a black woman wished to marry a white man, that was okay by him as long as she could stand it. But he clearly changes his mind between 1858, when he says black people should not be allowed to be voters, and 1865, when he says they should. So what happens? The main reason, I think, that Lincoln's attitude changes on this particular issue is because of black service in the Civil War. 180,000 black men served in the Union Armed Forces, and Lincoln believed that if you are willing to serve in the armed forces, you're entitled to the rights of citizenship. And Frederick Douglass, when he was encouraging his fellow blacks to join the Union Army, said, we can have a claim on the American public if we help them, help white people, attain what they want, which is victory in the Civil War. They will feel obliged to then extend to us citizenship rights. And Frederick Douglass was right. And Lincoln's changed attitude was largely a result of that service in the Civil War.
Someone asks, you mentioned that you thought you might end up looking like Abraham Lincoln, but I think you've done better. But the question is, what do we know about Lincoln's actual voice? Was it commanding, twangy, or none of the above?
One of the things that would surprise us most if we could hear tape recordings of Lincoln's speeches is that he had a high tenor voice. And it was remarked upon that it could be somewhat unpleasant to listen to. But it carried. Lincoln could address large crowds and be heard by thousands of people. Another thing that was remarkable about Lincoln's voice is the, and particularly after the age of 45, is the moral passion that he managed to convey through his speaking voice. And the people who heard him were mesmerized by the intensity and the passion of his delivery. Despite the rather unpleasant timbre of the voice, the way in which it was delivered, the earnestness which was evident in his voice was extremely effective and impressive. Another thing that I think would surprise us about Lincoln, if we were to hear tape recordings of his speeches, is that he spoke with something of what we would call today a hillbilly accent. He gives a famous speech in New York in 1860 at Cooper Union to a very sophisticated audience of knowledgeable New Yorkers. And he starts off by saying, "Mr. Chairman," and we know that he spoke in a hillbilly accent because some people who visited him in the White House went back and recorded in their diaries phonetically what Lincoln had said. And his Kentucky, Southwest Indiana accent was quite marked in those phonetic renderings of what Lincoln said, according to people who had actually spoken to him.
Okay, so we have another question. We know that Lincoln was virtually self-educated. Can you throw some light on that process?
Sure. Lincoln had less than 12 months of formal schooling, a little bit here, a little bit there. And he said in his one of his autobiographical statements that if you added it all up, it would be less than 12 months. That's a very sobering statistic for those of us in the education business. And he cared about education so much that he decided to send his firstborn son to the second best prep school and the second best college in the country. That's Exeter and Harvard. I went to Andover and Princeton. And his self-education consisted of wide reading, particularly in Shakespeare and the King James Version of the Bible, and the poetry of Robert Burns, the poetry of Lord Byron, and reading history. And for amusement, mind you, in his 40s, while he's out on the circuit, he would take books with him for reading pleasure. And one of the books that he took was Euclid, for fun. He mastered the first six books of Euclid's Geometry. And Lincoln felt had an inferiority complex about his lack of formal education. And he always felt inferior to people who had been to college, who had been to law school. And Lincoln actually suffered from an inferiority complex that had to do with that lack of education and also from his looks. Lincoln felt that he was ugly and unattractive, and he used to make jokes about ugly men, which were pretty self-referential. For example, he used to talk about the fellow who was sitting on a train, and a fellow comes up to him and points a gun right in his face and says, "I'm going to shoot you." And the fellow sitting down says, "Why? I don't know you. I haven't done anything to you. What gripe do you have with me?" The fellow with the gun says, "I vowed if I ever met a man uglier than I was, I'd shoot him." And the fellow sitting down said, "Stranger, if I am uglier than you are, go ahead and shoot. I don't want to live." So Lincoln's self-education was spotty. But one of the reasons he was able to write as well as he did was because of his command of Shakespeare and the Bible, that the cadences, the rich vocabulary, the kind of gnarled syntax is very reminiscent of both Shakespeare and the Bible. And this quality in Lincoln, I think, is a source of inspiration. And one of the things that I find striking about Lincoln is that he's a source of inspiration. He can be a source of inspiration not just to people who are born into abject poverty, although Lincoln was born into abject poverty, and he overcame it dramatically. But one of the things that I find quite striking about Lincoln is not just that he overcame economic poverty, but that he overcame emotional poverty. When you think that his mother dies when he's 9, his father's a very unsympathetic soul. He and his father are estranged. In fact, he was so estranged from his father that when he was in his early 40s, he received a letter from his stepbrother saying, "Our father is dying." This was in a town about 100 miles from Springfield, "and would like to see you now." And Lincoln writes back this remarkable letter in which he says to his stepbrother, "Tell our father that it would be more painful than pleasant if we were to see each other now." And no matter how estranged a child may be from a parent, the imminence of death usually acts as a solvent on that estrangement, but not in Lincoln's case. So Lincoln, I think, the emotional poverty of having an unsympathetic father, a father who discouraged him from reading, a father who would beat him for minor offenses, that is a source of severe emotional deprivation. Then he goes through a painful midlife crisis, as I suggested. He has a very unhappy marriage. He suffers a series of career failures and setbacks. And he has a tendency to depression, as we've already mentioned. And yet, he was able to overcome these and to become a model of psychological maturity, of emotional stability and rootedness, a model of moral clarity and unimpeachable integrity. And I think he serves can serve as an inspiration, not just to the people that he was contemporary with, but the story of Lincoln's life can be an inspiration to us all, that we too can go through a lot of emotional poverty and deprivation and still become not a world historical figure, to be sure, but somebody who has the psychological maturity and moral clarity and unimpeachable integrity.
Well, I want to actually ask you the big what-if question.
Sure.
Could Reconstruction possibly have gone better if Lincoln had lived? I mean, yeah, just leave it there.
Sure. This is a question that historians have grappled with for some time, and it's impossible to say for sure. But we do know. Let me rephrase it. When I was in secondary school, this is back toward the tag end of the Second Punic War, the standard interpretation of Lincoln and Reconstruction was this, that Lincoln had put forward in 1863 a mild set of peace terms, a Reconstruction policy called the 10% Plan, which would have allowed the rebellious states to come back into the Union and to have power in Congress and participate in presidential elections and the like. And that Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, had tried to implement that very same policy, and he got crucified by Congress. He was impeached and nearly removed from office. And it was lucky for Abraham Lincoln that John Wilkes Booth shot him when he did, because he too would have been crucified trying to implement this mild, generous set of peace terms. Well, that interpretation is not one that most historians today share, and I'm one of those. Because clearly, when Abraham Lincoln in 1863 put forward his 10% plan, he was trying to encourage the South to quit. He made that proposal after Gettysburg, where the South had suffered a terrible loss in July of 1863 at Gettysburg. At the same time, they lost Vicksburg, a very major defeat. And in late November 1863, they lost in Chattanooga. So no reasonable Confederate in December of 1863, when Lincoln put forward his 10% plan, could believe that the South was going to win on the battlefield. So what Lincoln was trying to do was to encourage them to throw in the towel, to surrender. And an easy set of peace terms seemed one way to induce them to surrender. However, once Lee had surrendered on April 9th, 1865, there was no reason for Lincoln to induce the South to surrender. They had been defeated. So what does Lincoln do 2 days after Lee surrenders? He offers a new Reconstruction proposal, one that includes black suffrage. And if Lincoln had lived, it's entirely possible that Reconstruction would have gone a lot more smoothly than it did. However, having said that, I should note that in some ways, the problem of Reconstruction was like the problem of squaring the circle. The two main questions that were dealt with in Reconstruction were, one, how are white Southerners going to be persuaded to feel like loyal Americans again? On the other hand, number two, how can the Emancipation Proclamation be made a living reality and not just a paper promise? The problem that Lincoln would face is that everything you did to promote one of those goals was at the expense of the other. That everything you did to promote black citizenship rights was interpreted by white Southerners as an insult, and everything that was done to placate white Southerners had to be done at the expense of blacks. And so even with his great statesmanlike skills, it's entirely conceivable that Lincoln could not have solve that problem.
Okay, I have a couple of questions about Team of Rivals here. Mm-hmm. Doris Kearns Goodwin's book. Was this as purposeful and successful, that is the cabinet making, as depicted there?
Yes, Lincoln's handling of the cabinet was a hallmark of his statesmanship, because in his cabinet he appointed all of the rivals that had been defeated by him at the Chicago Convention in 1860. And this took a lot of self-confidence on the part of Lincoln, because Lincoln was very much a dark horse in 1860. And he appoints to the cabinet his rivals, two of whom thought, with some reason, that they were far better qualified, that their resumes were far more impressive than Lincoln's, and that they deserved the presidency much more than he did. One of them was William Henry Seward, his Secretary of State, and the other was Salmon P. Chase, his Secretary of the Treasury. And Lincoln dealt with both of these gentlemen in a most remarkable way. Seward was so convinced that he was the man who was entitled to be president and was qualified to be president that 4 weeks after Lincoln's inauguration, Seward writes him a memo in which he says, well, you know, we don't have any foreign policy. We don't have any domestic policy. Some member of the cabinet ought to step forward and take charge. So basically, Lincoln was being told by his Secretary of State, you step aside, I'll take charge. And Lincoln very gently but very firmly puts him in his place, saying, we do have a domestic policy. We do have a foreign policy. You've agreed to it. And the person who's in charge should be the person who won the election. So if you'll just calm down, we'll get along. And they got along very well thereafter. Salmon P. Chase, on the other hand, didn't appreciate that quality in Lincoln and maneuvered to steal the presidency from Lincoln, to steal the nomination in 1864. And Lincoln showed remarkable patience, almost superhuman patience, in dealing with Chase. This is one of the most extraordinary qualities of Lincoln was his magnanimity. Chase, as I say, tried to steal the nomination, and he kept submitting his resignation. He told Lincoln, look, if you don't appoint this person to the post I want him appointed to, I'm going to quit. And if you don't adopt this policy I want to see adopted, I'm going to quit. So Chase submits his resignation, Lincoln backs down. He submits it again, Lincoln backs down. He submits it a third time, Lincoln backs down. Fourth time, Lincoln says, thank you, I accept, right when you get work. You know, good luck. And Chase was hard to get along with because he prayed every morning, and it was said that his theology was sound in every respect except one, and that is he thought there was a fourth personage in the Trinity, Salmon Chase. Lincoln also said that it would take a surgical operation to get a joke into his head. But Chase was a very important representative in the cabinet of the radical wing of the party. Seward was a very important representative of the conservative wing of the party. And you had to keep the party united. That was the secret to Northern success. You have to keep the North united, which means you have to keep the Republican Party united. And so Lincoln put up with a lot from Chase, finally accepts his resignation. But then even so, he appoints him to be Chief Justice of the United States a few months later. And Lincoln said, if my own personal feelings were the principal consideration, Chase would not have been appointed. I would rather eat the chair that I'm sitting in or swallow hot andirons than to name Chase. But he's an important representative of the cabinet of the radical wing, and he needs to be given this chief justiceship. And so Lincoln's ability to deal with these very difficult cabinet members, particularly Seward and Chase, is truly a remarkable chapter in his presidency and an indication of his statesmanship.
Okay, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's only time for one last question, so here it is. We've heard a lot of talk about the similarities between President Obama and President Lincoln. Has too much been made of this?
Well, they're both tall, skinny lawyers from Illinois. They both served four terms in the Illinois state legislature. They both served briefly in Congress before they became president. They both had difficult relationships with their fathers. They both took their oath of office in extremely trying times. And they're both, I think, are the only presidents who could make a living as a writer. So I think, yeah, there are a number of striking parallels, but the most striking difference is the nature of the crisis that is faced. Lincoln was a war president. Now, to be sure, we're at war in Iraq and we're at war in Afghanistan, but that's not the principal concern of the country. The principal concern is the economy. And so the analogy of Lincoln is less apt than the analogy with Franklin Roosevelt in terms of dealing with the challenge that's directly before him. Well, again, I thank you all for your attention, and I'll be happy to sign books.
Our thanks to Michael Burlingame, historian, and our thanks to Michael Burlingame, historian and author of the new two-volume work, Abraham Lincoln, A Life. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Tonight's program has been held in association with the Institute of Governmental Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. I'm Robin Einhorn, and now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.